May 15th, 1991, 3 p.m., Hearing Room 357, House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Family Justice.
The House Judiciary Subcommittee on Family Justice will come to order. We are one short of a quorum, but the chair is going to rule that the attendance of the Speaker of the House of Representatives as a, what would be the phrase, ex officio member constitutes the fifth member of our committee for purposes of a quorum. So we will move into, and if anyone would like to appeal that the ruling of the chair, feel free to go ahead. Hearing no appeal, then we will consider ourselves with a quorum, and Representative Edmondson takes away any doubt. So we will move into work session on House Bill 3375. Committee, this is a bill we saw once before, and you're going to see it in very different circumstances now. Council, can you give us an overview of what the bill did?
And still does. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3375 establishes procedures whereby discriminatory covenants that remain on title of the real property can be removed should the owner of the real property like to do that. It is a new provision, new addition to the statutory provisions. There is also an amendment that's being proposed to this bill, and the copies of the amendments, the dash ones, are in your packets, and Craig Campbell is here and speaker to address this issue.
Okay.
I have to admit that I will be happy to get off Shelley's case because I don't think I can even explain.
You've got to get off Shelley's case.
Yes.
All right. But this is a bill that was originally brought to us by Representative Shibley committee, and the committee heard some fair amount of testimony on that. I think the we're in work session, and so what we're going to do is ask Mr. Craig Campbell to come forward to talk with us about a proposed amendment. Otherwise, we will not be taking public testimony on the bill or the amendment. Mr. Campbell, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have you talked to us about Shelley's case?
Let me begin, first of all, by thanking Representative Shibley. I realize she's not here, but for allowing us to propose these amendments to her bill. To begin with, let me go ahead and read the rule in Shelley's case as it now stands in Oregon law. If a life estate in land is conveyed or devised to A, and by the same conveyance or device, a remainder in the land is limited immediately or immediately to the heirs of A or to the heirs of A's body, and the life estate and remainder are in the same quality, then A has, in addition to his life estate, a remainder in fee simple or fee tail. Now, if you were to just read that, I'm sure you'd be as confused as I was when I first read it. I had the privilege of listening to that in a property class. You'll have to forgive the two-page testimony that you have before me. I am a law student, and I tend to write like one. So I'm going to try and to describe the rule in Shelley's case as best as I can. Under the rule of Shelley's case, if I were to convey property to another, and when I convey that property, I restrict that conveyance so that when that person dies, the property then will go to their children or their heirs. The rule in Shelley's case forbids that transaction by giving the person who I conveyed the property to the entire rights to the property. That still might be a little confusing to you. So I'm willing to take any questions along the way.
Variation on the rule against perpetuities.
It's related to the rule in perpetuities, and the rule in perpetuities in California, there was a court ruling that said that if you don't understand the rule in perpetuities, you can't be sued for malpractice
right.
for it. So, so if you're confused on this case, that's a pretty reasonable thing.
Good. But it gets at the same concern.
Yes. The problem with the rule in Shelley's case is it was developed. The first cited case of the rule of Shelley's case was in feudal England in the year 1324. It was developed specifically for feudal law, and feudal law no longer applies. It was abolished in England in 1925 and has been abolished in over three-quarters of the states of the Union. The state of Oregon abolished the rule in Shelley's case for wills, but did not do so for the conveyance of property. Now, when you have a dead hand controlling the distribution of property and how it's, when I say dead hand, I mean after you've created a will, the person who is deceased still has some control over that land. And if the legislature was willing to give that person, who's now dead, control over their property in this respect, I think it makes sense for the legislature to go ahead and say that somebody who's living and is able to contract with somebody else to have those same rights. The way the rule stands right now, there are a couple of elements to it. One, that the deed or the instrument has to create a life estate in the person who's getting the land. In other words, they have a right to that land for their life, and then when they die, then it would go to their children or their heirs. The way the rule in Shelley's case works is it creates what's called a merger, and that is whatever the children would have gotten is now given to the parent, and that merges and becomes the entire rights to the property. To prevent myself from babbling on and on over the same, are there any questions?
Representative Terry.
Just a question. If the owner of the property conveys title to the property to another individual apart from the family and retains a life estate upon the sale, then does the property revert to the deed holder at the demise of the the owner, or does it then still go to the child?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanceri, I'm not sure if I understand what you're asking. Now, if you're asking if I, as an individual, conveyed to somebody who is not a member of my family and then asked for life estate,
correct,
and then there was a reversion back to my children?
Would there be a reversion back to the child after the death?
There is a different rule that applies to that, and what happens in that rule, and I quite honestly can't tell you the title of that rule, what happens is a similar thing to what happens in the rule of Shelley's case. The reversion doesn't go back to my children. Instead, it goes back to me, and then I can do with it as I please. So it has the same effect as a rule in Shelley's case. But the rule in Shelley's case only applies to a conveyance to somebody and then to their children. I could sell to a member of my family and then to their children, and that would not work under the rule of Shelley's case. Or I could sell it to somebody who is unrelated to me.
And Mr. Campbell, your amendment basically abolishes the rule of Shelley's case.
Right. As I said, it was already abolished as relation to wills under ORS 112.345.
And why, as a matter of policy, do we want to do that?
Basically, the rule has never been applied in Oregon. It's been cited in three cases, the last of which was, I believe, in 1987, but it was not dispositive to the case. It only gave an opinion as to how another rule would work. Right now, the way it acts is it acts sort of as a pitfall for an unwary lawyer, and as a result, if a lawyer was to write up an instrument that qualified under the rule, the person who would end up paying would be the lawyer's client. And to prevent that sort of thing, unless there's a real affirmative reason to keep something that was developed under feudal law, it should probably be taken out of an existing body of law.
Further questions, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
I'm just curious whether the House of Lords, excuse me, the Senate, is going to go along with this. I mean, we're violating 700, no, how many years of tradition? 600 years of tradition. Thank you.
I still want to know, if, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
I still want to know if the rule of Shelley's case was on the 1980 August bar exam.
Representative Edmondson.
Was Shelley a man or woman?
I can't answer that question, Representative Edmondson.
Shelley was a man.
Had to be a man.
I would assume so, since
women didn't own property in those
days. That was a bar exam question.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Campbell, you can relax. There won't be a bar exam next year. Those of us in Judiciary Committee get to have our way.
Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Reverend Mannix.
Since we're in work session, I move the Dash 1 amendments.
Reverend Mannix moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3375. Further discussion of amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Reverend Mannix.
I only feel like I ought to say something since this is a momentous occasion, but that's all I can say is something.
All right. Further discussion of the Dash 1 amendments. Is there
if we can't get rid of the bar exam, at least we can get rid of the
Shelley case. Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, it is adopted. Motion on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
Move the bill as amended.
Representative Mannix moves House
committee
Bill 3375 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bauman?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Oh, yes.
Representative Mannix?
Yes.
Representative Park?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri?
Aye.
Chair Clark?
Chair votes aye. Bill is passed to the full committee. And we're going to ask at the full committee Representative Mannix to make the presentation. And on the floor, we ask Representative Shibley to carry the bill and ask if the speaker would like to carry the portion of the bill relating to the rule in Shelley's case.
Well, I do thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to sit in and observe the testimony.
Right. Mr. Speaker, it's a pleasure to have you here. Mr. Campbell, thank you for bringing the amendment to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll ask Representative Shibley to carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3375 and open
3418.
Work session on House Bill 3418 and ask Mr. Zeitz and Mr. Burr to come forward. Council, can you remind us where we left off with this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill was introduced at the request of the City of Eugene, and in its original form would have deleted the name of the complaining party or a victim from a police report, which is then subject to public disclosure. There was some concern about that, particularly in light of the fact that the statute does contain language which allows a police agency to delay disclosure if there is a clear need to do so. At the request of the chair, Representative Bell met with the two witnesses at the table and myself and some others to attempt to come to some resolution and an amendment that would begin to address the concern that was raised. For the committee's information, and I think to put this into a context, I think the issue is not one of, and actually, I guess, for those of you that heard the King story on Monday, for which I'm, I guess, partially responsible, I think the concern that was raised by Representative Bell in this was not so much a question of abuse by the press or abuse by law enforcement in letting out the names of or releasing the names of complaining witnesses, victims. It was really more a separate concern, which is the privacy rights of the victim, particularly right after the incident occurs. And that, I think, it's important for the committee to keep in mind that the intent is not to deal with abuses, current perceived abuses or real abuses of what's going on. It's to address a whole separate issue that just happens to be sort of backdoored into this issue, which is the privacy rights of victims. There are Dash 1 amendments, which are in the committee's packet, which were ably drafted by Mr. Zeitz, and which I think everybody is in concurrence with, and I think they are here to explain them. Representative Bell might also want to speak to the issue.
Representative Bell? Mr. Zeitz, Mr. Burr, I don't know who wants to go first.
Okay. Essentially, Council's...
Your name for the record, I'm sorry.
Oh, my name is Tim Burr, and I'm the Public Information Officer for the Eugene Department of Public Safety. Council's overview assessment is very correct. We did meet with Representative Bell. I think that both sides had some concerns about the language in the bill as drafted. It's a very gray area, as this committee admitted when we appeared before it, a very controversial area. The language which Mr. Zeitz proposed is very acceptable. In our opinion, it does two things. As a matter of policy, it gives recognition to the concerns regarding safety of complainants and victims. It also sets forth victim and complainant safety as a criteria or test in determining what information to release. And we are perfectly satisfied with it.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Les Seitz. I'm a publisher of the Kaiser Times, appearing as a representative of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. Just to state for the record that we do support the Dash 1 amendments for the reasons that Tim Burr has outlined. And I'll leave it at that. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that.
Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just for your information, the reason that the bill, that the amendments are so long is that last legislature, there were changes that were made to the public records law that don't go into effect until July 30th, 1995. However, they are currently in statute, and so Section 3 of the bill, Section 2 of the printed bill, inserts the same language that you see on page 1, lines 4 through 8, into that second section of the statute. It's actually easier to read on page 2 than it is on page 1 because it's in bold print, but it's just a conformance amendment. The second one is really just a conformance amendment to Section 1, Section 2.
All right. Further questions, Mr. Chair? Representative Parks.
Mr. Zeitz, I'd like you to go into a little more detail so we have a better record as to what the amendment envisions will be the right of the press, the restrictions that would be on it, and the right of the victim, and therefore the restrictions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, As we see this amendment, what it does is it accomplishes two very important objectives, we believe. It maintains the press access and the public's access to police reports and documents, which we believe is fundamental, that there cannot be secrecy on police operations unless there are compelling reasons. So this bill does not in any way, as we view it, retreat from that first policy in the state. But secondly, it also recognizes that there are, in specific cases, good reason to protect the name, at least for a time, the name of a complaining party or a victim. What this does is essentially acknowledge what is working practice, at least in the state of Oregon, in any event. But it does sensitize law enforcement agencies that as they look at a report, that these are types of information that may be in a specific case, not as a matter of general policy, but in a specific case, should be withheld. But also, if an agency does make that determination, as it's proposed now, that still leaves the window open for the press and the public to appeal that retention of that information through the normal public records policy. So it allows some discretion to challenge a law enforcement agency's decision to withhold that information.
One more question. Yes, Bruce. The other gentleman that's appearing as a witness, you're shaking your head, but that won't be in the record. Do you agree with Mr. Zeik's analysis?
Yes, I concur. As Les has said, I think the issue is we have a mutual interest in recognizing some legitimate issues around victim identification, and yet this does preserve the option that the press has had of pursuing the matter through the public records law if they feel that that name is being withheld inappropriately.
So that in the vast majority of cases, that information be available, it would only be in a very limited number
Correct.
Of cases. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Parks. Further questions, Representative Mannix.
Council might be able to answer this better. On the last page of the amendment, Section 3, the amendments to ORS 192501 by Section 2 of this Act become operative on June 30, 1995. Section 2 of this Act apparently is now going to be presented in the amendments. I'm not following which Section 2 we're talking about. And I know you talked about the prior legislation. I'm still not tracking.
As this should have been written, the page 1, lines 4 through 9, is the new language that goes into the printed bill. And then the additional stuff, the new Section 2, is an add-on to this bill. Section 2 is new in the amendments.
Right.
Okay. But Section 2 actually exists in statute. So what you're reading, when it says ORS 192501 as amended, is actually in lieu of an ORS citation.
So this language that says the amendments to ORS 192501 by Section 2 of this Act, all of that is in the current ORS?
Is in current ORS and is in awaiting June 30th, 1995 to become effective. But because it's currently in statute, there was a necessity to make whatever changes were being made in 192 now to have it also apply when the new stuff comes
in. The 95 version will have this language and the current version will
Correct.
Have this language. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. We are in work session. So the chair would entertain a motion for the dash one amendments.
I'd move the dash one amendments.
Representative Parks moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3418. Representative Parks, I wonder if you would consider it a friendly amendment. I think it might help in terms of ease of reading. Page 1, line 6, and page 2, line 14, take out the words in a particular case. So that the sentence reads, the record of an arrest or the report of a crime shall not be confidential unless and only so long as there is a clear need to delay disclosure in the course of a specific investigation.
That's better wording.
Because I think the addition of the words in a particular case is a little bit confusing.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bell.
Ready for some discussion?
Yes.
I'd just like to hear from Mr. Zeitz because that was the wording that they agreed upon. I'd just like to hear if that...
Mr. Zeitz, we're talking about taking out the words in a particular case. They don't seem to add anything of substance, and perhaps it may make the amendment read a bit more clearly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was simply picking up language that's in existing statute. But I believe the language at the end about a specific investigation serves that similar purpose, so I don't see that that's a problem.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Judge Parks, you consider that a friendly amendment?
Yep.
All right. Then the dash one amendments as slightly modified have been moved. Further discussion?
Yes. I'd like to raise a question as to some other ambiguous or negatory type language.
Right.
That's a negative language, where it says, shall not be confidential unless and only so long as. That's a double negative concept. Even it's on the amendments, it's also in current statute, where it says, the record of an arrest or the report of a crime shall not be confidential unless and only so long as. It seems to me the same purpose can be achieved if we stated this positively. Shall be confidential if and only if, or if, I'm trying to think of some language that's positive rather than double negative. That's what I'm coming up with. Shall be confidential so long as there is a clear need. If you just say shall be confidential so long as, but then we talk about it all being available. I'm just throwing it out for discussion.
Representative Edmondson.
I would not, as first blush, I don't think that that would be necessarily a technical amendment. The policy should be that records will not be confidential. In other words, records will be open and with exceptions, as opposed to saying records will be closed with exceptions. And so I think that's an important thing.
Well,
and I also just would say that to say that the phrase unless and only so long as, to me, incorporates two situations. One would be that they will not be confidential unless, and that's sort of a open-ended disclosure, or basically open-ended secrecy. But and only so long as would impose a limit on that, so that there, even though there may have been a reason to keep records confidential, at one point, when those conditions cease to exist, then the presumption no longer lies.
May I try something else, Mr. Chairman?
The next.
How about shall be disclosed unless and only so long as there is a clear need?
Oh, well, that would be.
All right, we have another friendly amendment
that would be
Judge Parks's. Judge Parks, that's a friendly amendment.
Shall be disclosed.
I just had to read this original language three times before I could understand it, and I thought if we say it positively.
All right, so.
You want to say it once more then?
All right, so it would read, the record of an arrest or the report of a crime shall be disclosed unless and only so long as there is a clear need to delay disclosure, and we're still using the disclosure concept.
Further discussion.
And we'd use that in both places. Thank you.
Further discussion to the motion. Is there objection to the motion? Adopted. Motion on the bill. Representative Parks moves House Bill 3418 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bauman?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Yes.
Representative Mannix?
Yes.
Representative Parks?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri?
Aye.
Chair Clark?
Aye. Chair votes aye. The bill is passed. I'll ask Representative Edmondson and Representative Bell to carry the bill. The Eugene contingency. Close the work session on House Bill 3418. And let's get on this one.
Okay. Let's kick this out. Then we can have this one.
Open up a brief work session on House Bill 3318. This is the Sex Offenses Against Children Task Force, 3313, I'm sorry. And we have some proposed amendments that I believe are going to be brought to us by Representative Bell and her able assistant. Correct?
Yes.
Her able assistant.
Can I speak?
Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will find in your packet dash one amendments dated 5991. They are a rewrite of this bill, which would legislatively create a sex offenses against children task force. I don't want to steal the thunder of the witnesses, so I will let them pick up from here. They have worked hard on this.
Representative Bell and Andrea Pasula.
welcome. We look forward to the amendments. I tell the committee that not only is Andrea Pasula Representative Bell's fine assistant, but last session she was my fine assistant and probably singularly more responsible for me being in this building than any one person, but you won't hold that against her, please.
Nor the fact that she's seriously thinking about applying to law school.
Right.
Which is, we also which won't hold against
worse,
her.
Which is even
does
a worse mistake.
Does she know there's a glut of lawyers?
Does she
know? Father is the last prospective lawyer in here. Did you notice that?
All right.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Marie Bell. I'm State Representative in District 41, and I have with me today Andrea Pasula, who has prepared some amendments for House Bill 3313. And she'll explain why the necessity for the amendments and how they came about.
For the record, my name is Andrea Pasula, Legislative Assistant to Representative Marie Bell, District 41. There are several amendments on this bill. First one I'd like to address is in Section 1 on lines 12 and 15, which specifies the membership of the task force, that one from each, two from the Senate, two from the House of Representatives, one from each of the majority and the minority reporter. And that was discussed in the last hearing on this bill. After the last hearing on the bill, I spoke with Connie Jacoby, who's from Protective Services, about some possible federal money from the Children's Justice Act. And there's some specific requirements that are in that act. I believe you have a copy of that. And so we redrafted the bill to take into consideration those requirements. One of the requirements is the membership of the task force and that several different groups be represented. And you can see that on the amendments on lines 19 through page 2 on line 4, which talks about the different groups.
Quick question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Maddox.
My only problem here is with all those different groups having to be represented, is 15 members going to be enough when you've got two senators and two representatives and you've got 11 slots left? I guess you'd have to have some people who are multiple players who cover diverse interests.
That's something the committee can decide.
Okay.
But what the current makeup, the number of the committee is supposed to be, what, 15?
Got longer.
How many people are on that list?
11. I think Representative Mannix said 11.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Sanseri.
I'm the one that moved 11. That we have add two senators and two members of the House, and I'm certainly open to see that change to one if it facilitates this these amendments.
Let me, okay, I appreciate that, Representative Sanseri. Let me ask the witnesses on page 2, lines 2 and 3. We have both an entry for parents and for representative of parents' groups. And I wonder what the policy reason is for having both of those entries.
That is taken directly from the Child Abuse Prevention Act, from the words that were in that, which specifies both parents and representatives of parents' groups.
Mr. Chairman?
Submit.
I guess my suggestion here would be that it's typical federal drafting. I'm taking a very snooty Oregon view of what the federal government or Congress does to us sometimes, but we can live with it.
They need you up there.
We can live with it because we can have someone who's a parent who also represents a parent's group, who's also experienced with working with children with handicaps because the parent has children with handicaps. I mean, I could probably combine five of these. There's no requirement in the federal law that you have to have a separate person representing each of these groups. Is there? Okay, we can live with it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? Just a comment back to Representative Sinceri's comment. Personally, I believe it's important to leave that in because of the nature of the legislation, hopefully, that will come from this task force and the fact that we need to carry it through both houses, irregardless of which party is in control.
All right. Committee, I'm going to suggest that we just leave it as it is. I don't think you want a task force much larger than 15 because group dynamics will tell you you can't get anything done with a group much larger than 15.
As the House representative finds out.
What?
Is there a federal requirement that the senators and representatives have these experiences? Because I guess we could find a couple of senators and representatives who are going to meet these requirements. So maybe, I was thinking maybe we ought to exempt them from these requirements, but
I'll back off on that, too. I think it's flexible enough.
Go ahead with your testimony, Andrea.
For the changes that we made...
I'm having a little bit of a hard time hearing you.
Okay. On page 2 on line 7 of the amendments, we also made a change to add the words, make legislative recommendations to the purposes of the task force, the idea being that they can come up with specific ideas so it's not just open and that they study the problem. Further changes, lines 12 through 23, again match the Federal Child Abuse Prevention Act on the requirements that they have for what the task force study. And again, that's taken directly from the wording on the Child Abuse Prevention Act. One last amendment that is not on your amendment that we'd also like to try to add in is after F on line 24, to add in section C, that the task force will act in an advisory capacity to the designated agency for receipt of federal dollars through the Children's Justice Act. And that's, again,
can,
merely
can
just
you read that again? That would be...
Certainly.
Okay, it's in a hand-engrossed
right.
copy. Act in advisory capacity to the designated agency for receipt of federal dollars through the Children's Justice Act.
Very helpful language in the bill as it's presented before you today. However, I think it would be more helpful if the legislature took this opportunity to clearly define, as you have the authority to do, exactly what constitutes a contempt or what is required to prove contempt.
Okay. In that context, what is either A, existing law, or B, Senate Bill 376 say about, and I've never understood this about contempt, criminal contempt, state of mind. If I don't pay child support, one of the hammers that is held over my head is the threat of contempt.
Correct.
If it's determined to be willful.
Correct.
But that would be a willful determination not to pay child support, not, I'm the old concept of mens rea, mental state to commit a crime. What is existing law and what does the bill do to the whole concept of state of mind?
Well, let me comment.
In the criminal context.
I would suggest to you that that is still unclear, both in the current law, and I think that that's been suggested by both Judge Lipscomb and Mr. Linden in their prior testimony. Currently, it's unclear exactly what mens rea is required. And I would suggest also that the bill, as proposed, does not make that aspect any more clear. The bill, as proposed, does say that the contempt must be willful, but it doesn't go on to define that any more than is currently in effect. It does add one aspect to the current situation, which is it provides that inability to comply with the order is an affirmative defense. I think that's a valuable and necessary addition, but it does nothing to make it any more clear, again, what the elements, including the intent of the non-complying person, is. And that's where I think the bill can be improved.
Do you have some suggestions for us?
I do, and I've included that in my written testimony, but briefly what I would suggest is that a provision be included which states clearly the following, proof of the existence of an order, proof of the contemnor's knowledge of that order, and proof of noncompliance with that order establishes a prima facie case. Then the next element of the law is the provision that provides that
it shifts the burden.
No, it doesn't shift the burden. You don't want to talk about that because that's not what happens. The next element is that inability to comply is a affirmative defense. Now, that does not act to shift the burden of proving an element.
Right.
And that's very important because that's, I mean, that's not allowed by Constitution.
Right. Criminal 101.
Right. It's the burden of going forward versus the burden of proving an element.
Right. Okay.
So that, I think, language would enhance, and it would very much help someone like me who deals with this every day and every week in numerous cases.
So. Okay. So you had the situation, the trees on the land, you would have to find not only that the person knew there was a lawsuit, but that they knew there was a specific order in effect.
That's right. The person knew there was an order prohibiting him or her from cutting that tree
down. I guess you'd have to have language in there about knew or should have known, wouldn't you? I didn't know there was an order in effect because I didn't want to know.
Understand, though, from the beginning that if the contempt action is brought on the underlying order, and it can only involve a party to that underlying action.
Okay.
So the order binds all the parties.
All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm going to stop with your permission, Mr. Chairman. And
I have my permission to stop. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Not you specifically, but people generally. Mr. Stecker.
My name is Carl Stecker. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. And I had a couple of specific concerns. I will just for a moment back up and relate that Mr. Linden did appear in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and made a record, I believe, that this criminal contempt was not envisioned as a wholesale new remedy that would be available to vindicate the private rights of a vast majority of prejudiced obligees, I guess, or people that were affronted by contemnor's conduct. Rather, it was seen, I think, as a very limited right in the exceptional case. And our concern remains that right now, there in sections 6 and 16 of the bill, there are provisions by which the special prosecutor is appointed on the county's dime or at the state's expense. And our main concern with that is that those cases not be there not be such a volume of cases, obviously, that it impacts us negatively. There are a couple of preconditions that were, at our suggestion, I believe, included in the engrossed version, and those were that there be, initially at least, some showing that remedial sanctions would not be appropriate. I would mention at this juncture that there are also, obviously, district attorneys have criminal authority, and sometimes the choice is made to bring a felony indictment. And that similar type of action, a criminal proceeding that's initiated by district attorneys should also stand in lieu of a prosecution for criminal contempt or criminal sanctions for contempt. Secondly, as to the other provision that was inserted over the suggestion of one of the senators was that that the special prosecutor not be a party for one of the interested parties. And that means then the interested party, as for the reasons that Mr. Pugh has already referred to, does not have a representative in that capacity. And so we do question why criminal, basically the ability to bring a criminal sanction would be removed from the private bar. The second issue that I raise in my testimony is with regard to compulsion of testimony. There's about a 7-year-old Oregon Supreme Court case that relies heavily on a decision by Justice Gillette in State versus Soriano. And State versus Soriano essentially says that if you compel testimony, that you must then grant transactional immunity, which is the broadest species of immunity that can be granted. And it says essentially that you cannot then be compelled or you cannot be prosecuted for any subsequent offense that relates to that testimony that was compelled. Our concern here is only that certainly this is very pronounced in a child support enforcement case that a contemnor who is compelled to testify in 1991 regarding conduct that is then completed, that testimony not in any way, shape, or form prevents subsequent prosecutions when he fails to pay in 1992 or 93 and a subsequent proceeding is brought. And we've talked with Mr. Ross Shepard from OCDLA, and he's agreed that's appropriate. So we want to make that clear in the legislative record. The other thing that concerns us, I guess, is ORS 136.619, which is not within the bill, but that provides that this grant of transactional immunity also prohibits forfeitures. And obviously in the child support context, if an obligor in compelled testimony reveals the source of his employment, we don't think that should be interpreted as a forfeiture, which would preclude assignment of wages, garnishment of bank accounts, that sort of thing. So we'd be concerned only about that. Second to finally, I would like to address Mr. Michael Wells had sent a letter to committee counsel, I believe, concerning a proposed amendment. I have addressed that in my testimony. I think that it's broad in the sense that it, first of all, relates only to contempt cases. It relates to all contempt cases and not those that are limited to child support. These amendments were in part brought on by the State versus McAllister decision, which was alluded to, I think, by Mr. Linden recently. And that case basically dealt with the ability of the contemnor to plead the privilege against self-incrimination and avoid further prosecution if he were compelled to testify under the criminal non-support statute. I think that Mr. Wells' suggestions are too broad in this regard. The first part of his phrase obviously is not limited to contempt for child support. It's broadly contempt. Second thing, though, it's narrow in its reference to 163.555, which is the criminal non-support statute. The problem with that is if in the course of a child support prosecution, for example, the contemnor blurts out that he murdered his wife yesterday, is he then granted transactional immunity for that conduct? And so it should be more narrowly subscribed, I think. Finally,
Yes. I'll ask you the same question. Do you have some proposed language?
I do not. I only mentioned the pitfalls, I think, that exist with the proposal as made. I'm sure that could be worked out, though.
What I might ask you to do is to either work with Mr. Linden or submit maybe a brief letter, perhaps, for our consideration on that. I don't often ask for that, but it might be helpful.
Certainly. And in the context of this proceeding, I think it's imperative that if the private bar is able to wag the tail of the dog or wag the dog by basically invoking transactional immunity, that there has to be notice to the state. There's too many instances, certainly. For example, the Attorney General obviously takes assignments on child support, and they would be precluded from further action by the actions of the private attorney. Finally, just a technical amendment, section line 17, page 3 of the Ingross Bill, section 5, subsection 6, seems to limit the ability to impose a remedial sanction only to those cases which are actually afforded in a hearing. So I have a specific amendment in my testimony that would enable us to continue the present practice of taking a stipulated order which waives the right to a hearing. And that's certainly done presently when an obligor comes in and his counsel says, yeah, there's no doubt about it, he's in contempt, he didn't pay, he knows about the order. And what can we do about this? We can fashion relief ourselves, present it to the court. The court has then the opportunity to accept or reject that, and in my experience has uniformly accepted it.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Maddox.
I'll simply second the chairman's request for a letter outlining perhaps some proposed language as to concerns you have. Because of the complex area that we're dealing with here, that would be very helpful as a guide to how we ought to approach amendments to the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would you allow me a brief closing
remark?
Sure. I simply want to point out to the committee that the proposed legislation before you provides for two separate contempt procedures, one for punitive contempt, one for remedial contempt. My suggestion to the committee is that two procedures are not necessary. Certainly, they're not required by constitutional or federal law, nor are they required by the state constitution. My proposal is to create only one clearly defined procedure. There will be some additional safeguards in a punitive contempt action that are not necessary in a remedial contempt action, but that does not mandate two separate procedures. That goes again to the question of who can initiate a punitive as well as a remedial contempt. And I've enclosed suggested language and suggested amendments along with my testimony that I would encourage you to consider as you're reviewing
bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Pugh, Mr. Hecker, Mr. Stecker, thank you very much. It's been very helpful comments. Mr. McLaughlin.
Thank you, Chairman Clark. I have for the committee brief, and they are brief, they are not very long, prepared testimony together with two proposed amendments that are on the last page. I appreciate the opportunity to speak this afternoon. You heard from Mr. Pugh and Mr. Stecker, who are both deputy district attorneys who work and work extensively in the child support area. In one sense, I'm the other side of the government house. I work in the Civil Enforcement Division at Justice, and we litigate a great deal of contempt cases that are in the non-child support area. We litigate cases primarily for the licensing agencies and boards of the state, where those boards and agencies are attempting to enforce, through the court system, their responsibilities to regulate various professions. We additionally, of course, litigate a large number of cases under the State Unlawful Trade Practices Act and the other plaintiff statutes, if you will, that the state, that the legislature has committed to the Department of Justice and the state agencies as representatives of the sovereign. In that respect, I think it's important for this committee to note and to keep in mind as it proceeds through this bill that the bill that you pass out to the House is a bill that's going to impact the use of the contempt statutes in areas far beyond just the child support cases. We have two problems with the bill as it came over from the Senate and two suggestions for you. Those suggestions are relatively short, and at least one of which I'm sure is going to be somewhat controversial given the comments that Representative Mannix made previously. The first suggestion we have has to do with the standard of proof or burden of proof that is laid out in the statute for the remedial sanction. Frequently, when we hear the word remedial sanction, we think of a direct equivalent to civil contempt. And we hear civil contempt, we think there's no possibility of a person being incarcerated. In fact, historically, there has been that possibility. A person can be incarcerated for civil contempt. That possibility carries through with this bill under the rubric or label of remedial contempt. As it came through, however, the Senate, on page 3 of the A. Engrossed version in, I believe it's section 5, sub 11, has set up a two-tier burden of proof for remedial contempts. If the sanction to be imposed by the court in the remedial contempt involves incarceration, the petitioner, the plaintiff, if you will, the party seeking the remedial sanction, has got to prove the contempt beyond a reasonable doubt. If, as the Senate bill came over, the party seeking the remedial sanction doesn't seek a sanction of incarceration, then the proof need only be by the clear and convincing standard, which historically has been the standard in Oregon for civil contempt. The problem that I bring to you and point out to you as a daily practitioner in the trial courts is that the party seeking the contempt sanction doesn't know and really should not know beforehand which of the various tools are available to the court that the court wants to utilize, will decide are necessary to utilize to compel compliance with the court's order.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
Can I just interrupt? Also, if you were required to make an election as the prosecutor in a case, and you elected for the incarceration sanction and you couldn't prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt, even if you reached clear and convincing, you would get nothing. But if we don't make the distinction and you don't have to elect and you don't prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt, you still have the remedial sanction available to you. Is that more the interest?
Chairman Clark, Representative Bauman, you've jumped a step ahead of me. That is one of the concerns we have. What you would normally do as a trial practitioner would be to do your darndest to prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt, The way the bill came over from the Senate, it is not at all clear what would happen if you didn't. It may be that this committee could deal with that, but I think it is much simpler to provide for a single burden-approved standard in the remedial contempt area. That's the first concern we have. It's dealt with in a good deal longer, two pages or so in the prepared testimony, and there is a proposed amendment that would simply deal with that problem. The second area that we have a concern with is quite simply the limitation that's contained on page 5 of the A engrossed version as it came over from the Senate at lines 17 and 18, and that's in section 9.1b. I can see myself getting ready to run into a buzzsaw from Representative Mannix. Our suggestion, quite simply, is this. The six-month limitation that came over from the Senate is inappropriate in the remedial contempt sanctions.
Mr. Chairman?
Not to be a buzzsaw, but why can't we have a provision that says that 6 months, another judge would have to reevaluate the entire matter, have an appearance, have a contempt proceeding, and that there could be further sanction imposed? But, you know, you're saying that someone could be kept in jail for 50 years if the judge is still in office, gets reelected. Isn't there a balance in there somewhere where you could say, here's the time limit, time's up? We don't even put sex offenders in jail for 6 months, unfortunately.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I think the proposal you make, allowing successive remedial or civil contempt actions, is one method of dealing with that problem.
Does that raise double jeopardy problems?
No, I don't think it does in the civil context or the remedial context. It does not. The concern that we have with the flat six-month limit without an ability to bring it back to another judge is that if you set out in the statute a six-month limit, you're essentially telling folks that if you can do 6 months, you can get away with it. And I think you're inviting precisely the kind of conduct you're trying to deter. Those are our concerns.
Okay.
We have, as I said, suggested amendments there. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you folks have.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate
your
testimony and all the witnesses. Representative Mannix has asked to be involved in this bill, and so since there is some substantial disagreement, I'm going to ask, Mr. Linden, would you be willing to work with Representative Mannix and the folks who have brought us some concerns, see what we can agree on and what we can't agree on, and come back next time we revisit this bill with those agreements, disagreements, any other comments that you would have at that point?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be very happy to do that. It's essentially what we did on the Senate side, where every time we turned around, a new issue came up on this bill, and we've got this informal working group together.
Good.
And we'd be happy to work with Representative Mannix. Some of the issues you've heard today are, a few of them are new issues to me.
Right.
Some were rehashed on the Senate side, but I think that...
And recognizing that the committee's going to have to just take a couple of these issues and go up or down with them.
You will probably end up with a few of those.
Right, and that's fine. That's what we're
here
for. Representative Bauman.
I just wanted to ask my question. I mean, the sum of my experience with contempt is as a deputy DA doing child support enforcement. And occasionally the judge would send a, you know, person to jail for a couple days to make it clear that he or she was serious, usually after quite a few appearances on a pretty regular basis without anything being paid. Did the discussion about the election and the problem that creates come up in the Senate? And did it come up as a, as like taking away a tool for child support enforcement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bauman, it wasn't certainly my impression as the Senate worked through this that we were attempting or actually taking away any tool for enforcement. The difference in the burden of proof issue,
right.
in particular.
Right.
We ended up with three different types of cases and proceedings in which they wanted to distinguish the burden of proof. In the punitive sanctions, clearly beyond a reasonable doubt had to apply. Originally, the remedial sanctions were the clear and convincing standard. However, the Senate Judiciary Committee decided to apply beyond a reasonable doubt in remedial sanctions involving confinement. The theory being these people are being confined just as someone can be confined in a punitive sanction, and they ought to have the same standard burden of proof apply in those settings. And that's why the Senate committee ended up where they did. Senator Bunn in particular was very concerned about that issue and proposed that amendment, and it was, if I recall correctly, narrowly adopted. So it was one of those policy calls that the committee may want to revisit.
Mr. Linden, thank you. We appreciate
thank
being
you.
Here. All right. We will close the any further witnesses on Senate Bill 376? We'll close the... Oh, is there? Yes? No?
It's your call. Do you want to go ahead?
Representative Clark, I would prefer to testify when you hear...
You come back?
Yeah.
Great. We'll be glad to do that.
That's all I wanted to
Thank
say.
You.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 376, and we will briefly... Committee, we have one more bill to take up. I don't think it will take real long, and we lose our quorum in 10 minutes. So move into work session... No, public hearing on Senate Bill 451, and ask Marcia Morgan to come up. Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 451 was introduced at the request. Senate Bill. I keep getting that wrong. Senate Bill 451 was introduced at the request of the Governor's Task Force on Corrections Planning. What it proposes to do is require that pre-sentence investigations be done on all felony sex offenses. The current law requires that it be done either at the request of the judge or the DA or under sentencing guidelines cases if there's going to be a departure. There is testimony submitted from the Department of Corrections. Barbara McGuire is here and can answer any questions that the committee may have from the department's point of view.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Morgan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marcia Morgan. I was the executive director of the Governor's Task Force on Corrections Planning and will speak to you today in that capacity, not in my present capacity with Lane County. Vern Fotz, a member of the committee, had to get back to work and unfortunately was unable to stay to also address this issue. You're probably familiar with the Governor's Task Force on Corrections Planning. We existed from 1988 just through 1990. Came out with two reports. The first one was a 10-year plan on what should be done in the state in terms of corrections. The last report, which came out in July, looked at some specific areas. Governor Goldschmidt asked us to look specifically at adult sex offenders from the point of conviction on. What types of issues can we be addressing there and hopefully deal with this growing population? As you know, there's the general prison population right now in Oregon is about 6,200. About 1,200 of those are sex offenders. Another 2,400 sex offenders are out on parole or probation. What we tried to do then is a comprehensive approach on how to deal with this population. We came up with two bills. The one today is one of those bills, but it is looked at more or less as a package. The mandatory PSIs for sex offenders, and I probably should say pre-sentence investigation because I was out in the hall saying something about PSIs for sex offenders and they thought I meant public service announcements rather than PSAs, but major difference there.
Or they thought you were talking about tires.
Pardon me?
They thought you were talking about air pressure in tires.
That might have been what it was. nonetheless, we felt as a task force that it was important to look at what was happening at that point of conviction in the courtroom. Because of sentencing guidelines, we're finding that not that many cases are they using PSIs anymore, but that it was a very important tool to find out the history, to find out more information about sex offenders, but mostly in terms of punishment and control of those offenders. There were three critical reasons we felt it was important. The first was so prosecutors and defense attorneys could help determine the appropriateness of plea negotiations. The second was for judges to determine the appropriateness of sentences of incarceration and community supervision. And the third was for the Department of Corrections to determine the appropriate placement of sex offenders in community sanctions and supervision. As was mentioned earlier by Holly, that there are two ways in which PSIs are currently implemented. One is at the request of the sentencing judge, and the other is if there is a departure from sentencing guidelines. There was some discussion about if this is the appropriate vehicle to get that information available, or if it should be done at the Clackamas Intake Center. The task force, as well as our 15-member advisory group, which was made up of treatment providers, we had defense attorneys, prosecutors, judges, felt that that was too late in the process, that we really needed to do it much sooner so that the information goes along and can certainly be utilized at the intake level. But we do need to know right up front when we're determining what's going to be happening with that individual. Currently, as I mentioned, it's optional for the PSIs to occur. In the state from 1990, about 54% of all the convictions of rape and sodomy, a PSI was requested. So we're looking at a little over half of those cases. Currently, they are requesting it.
Ms. Morgan, I'm going to stop you right there.
Sure.
Ask the committee right up front if there are any questions. Because I think that you're probably going to have a friendly audience here.
I was going to say that was actually okay. The end of my testimony.
The only question I would ask is about cost. I see in your testimony that someone's... Corrections Division, okay, expecting about a $60,000. In fact, this bill does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and I'm not inclined to tag one on there, unless you're going to beg me to do that.
I won't.
All right. Further testimony on Senate Bill 451. We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 451.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Baumann.
I move Senate Bill 451 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Baumann, move Senate Bill 451 full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Baumann.
Aye.
Representative Bell.
Aye.
Representative Mannix.
Aye.
Representative Parks.
Aye.
Chair Clark.
Chair votes aye. The bill is passed to the full committee. And we'll ask Representative Baumann.
Yes, I'd like to
carry that bill. Thank you. And I'm sorry to keep you folks around so long. If I'd have known it was going to be that quick, we'd have gotten you on and off sooner. Anything further to come in front of the committee? If not, we are adjourned.